In our last segment, we were talking about what's going on with PG&E and Southern California Edison with their precautionary power outages. Coming up on Take Two with A. Martinez at 2 o'clock, a look at San Diego Gas and Electric's plan for more precise preemptive power shutoff. So the third of the big three of the utility companies in California will be the focus on Take Two with A. Martinez, 2 o'clock this afternoon here on KPCC. Also, important programming reminder, this afternoon at 5 o'clock, we'll bring you live NPR-anchored coverage of the Democratic candidates' debate from Ohio. We'll have that for you in its entirety, nearly 3 hours long, but starting at 5 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPCC. If you want to go back to hear a bit more about the Tyler Skaggs investigation, the late Angels pitcher who died in his bed in a hotel room earlier this summer, yesterday we spoke with the ESPN Outside the Lines reporter who broke the story. That's archived. You can find it on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with the Dr. Timothy Fong, UCLA professor of addiction psychiatry, about what's colloquially talked about as a high-functioning addict. Let me bring Liz in Santa Ana into the conversation. Liz, thank you so much for joining us. How long have you been sober?
About 5 months.
All right, so you're fairly new into this. Please share with us what your experience of addiction was like and how you functioned while using.
After the passing of my mother and my father and my daughter's father, within about a two-year period, I had trouble controlling my emotions, as I seem to be now.
It's all right.
So I turned to speed. I had dabbled in meth over the years, you know, when I was younger. So I found that this particular drug was able to hold down all of my emotions so I could function, so I wouldn't cry all the time. And it did very well for me. I'm a waitress and a restaurant assistant manager, and I went to work every day. I raised my daughter. I have a very sort of high energy level on my own, and I think that the speed sort of tempered that out a little.
Yeah.
So I don't think that I was obvious in my, and I say that I was more definitely dependent. I don't think I was addicted to it, but as you can tell, I still. So what happened was those issues never went away, and then I've decided I can't do the drugs anymore. I'm lucky enough to have the support around me that to work through the issues that caused me to want to turn to something to suppress them anyways.
Liz, and, that's so good you have that support around you now. What was it that made you decide that you didn't want to use anymore?
Well, this particular substance is just yucky. It messes with every system you have. I'm taking some kind of nourishment for my brain as well, because of the pathways of my brain have been somewhat rerouted in a manner, you could say. And I just decided I'm 55 years old, and this is just stupid. And if something were to happen to me related to that, I would be so embarrassed for my family. I'm just so embarrassed now. So several people know in my very small circle, but no one at my workplaces know that every day they've ever worked with me before April, I had been on speed, and I would just put it in my coffee or do it before I went to work.
Yeah.
I ended up smoking quite a bit because the active snorting leads to symptoms that people could tell.
Yeah. Liz, you know, I know you know this intellectually, but, you know, you're among literally millions of people, and that, you know, the embarrassment that you feel, while certainly understandable, what you're going through and what you did is just very human. And you're in very good company with people who've gone through this.
I wanted to say that the issues that I was dealing with, the issues of loss and things that were left undone, can really lead people, you know, however they deal with it. And we really need to have, you know, the call for mental health has been getting much louder. And mental health doesn't mean you're crazy or that something happens. We need mental health interaction every day almost, because
yeah,
we have every other kind of interaction.
Liz, so the support you have, the professional support or familial support or all of that?
Yes, I have. Actually, I have all of that. I'm seeing a therapist. I go to counseling twice a week.
Great.
It's absolutely wonderful, and it is had to be the both the combination of it was the time for me to stop, as well as the ability to be able to pay for those services.
Liz, we're all pulling for you. Everybody hearing this, we're in your corner. And it's terrific. You have 5 months of sobriety. That's wonderful. And as you build in strength, as time goes on, it's I'm sure going to get better. Liz, thank you so much.
You're not keeping a secret. Oh my gosh, I have way more time because I'm not looking for some place to ditch it to do something.
No, good for you, Liz. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing your experience, and I'm sure there are many listeners. In fact, I see calls coming in right now. People who say that's me. I can relate to that experience. Joining us is Judith Grizel, who's professor of psychology at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. She's the author of Never Enough: The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. She herself has been sober for 30 years. But was a user. Judy, thank you for being with us. First of all, your thoughts on our caller starting us out.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I want to say congratulations to Liz, and I have been where she is. I was a stimulant abuser also, and it gets better. And I completely agree with her that using as many tools as possible is the way to go. So getting support from all over the place and just, you know, keeping a day at a time kind of mentality and getting through another day. And eventually the brain does heal. So there's a lot of changes that happen in the brain as a result of chronic drug use. And it takes time to undo those. And I think in terms of Skaggs, I think that he was really evidencing tolerance, and that's why he was able to look like he was high functioning. Of course, that whole idea fell apart when he overdosed.
Yeah.
That wasn't so high functioning, but up until that time, I think he was able to hide it because we become dependent so that we need the drugs to look normal, and without the drugs, it would be obvious that he had a problem.
We're talking with Judith Grizel, professor at Bucknell University. Also with us, Dr. Timothy Fong of UCLA, professor of addiction psychiatry. We have more listener calls to take. We're asking you about your experience if you're someone who is functioning at a high level professionally while suffering with addiction. What was it that helped you reach that tipping point of stopping to use, finding sobriety? 866-893-KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. We're talking about functioning at a high level professionally while addicted to substances. Rafi in Palos Verdes. Rafi, what was your experience with this?
My experience was that I was able to function at a very high level while addicted to multiple substances. I was able to complete medical school, residency training, and practice for almost 5 years while being addicted to alcohol, cocaine, and benzodiazepines.
Wow. How do you think you did that in something as demanding as medical school and practice?
Well, it was something that I used initially to sort of escape and wind down from, you know, the demands of training and education. And it got to a point where what I believe to be, you know, an addictive personality caused me to use with more and more frequency and build tolerance. And I think, you know, once that tolerance built to a certain level, I was unable to function without them.
What got you clean and sober?
I've been sober now for almost 4 years, and it was actually mitigating circumstances that resulted in my sobriety. There was an anonymous call made to the medical board, and that caused an investigation, and my medical license was subsequently put on probation with a number of stipulations, including things that I do now to stay sober, including attending weekly health support group meetings, 12-step recovery, and most importantly, accountability through random urine drug testing.
Rafi, have you been able to resume your practice?
Yeah, I practice with certain limitations, but I am able to practice on a daily basis and provide care to my patients.
And have you found new ways of dealing with the stress of your work for which the drugs and alcohol at least initially helped you?
Absolutely, and that's a key component, I believe, to a healthy recovery. I've been able to find hobbies and take up old hobbies, things like scuba diving and record collecting and, hanging out with my dog, who I can hear, I'm sure, in the background.
Yeah.
But, that has been a key to maintaining my sobriety.
Rafi, thank you so much, and congratulations. 4 years of sobriety, a very demanding profession, and, of course, your educational program that led into that. Rafi, I appreciate it. Let me go back to Dr. Timothy Fong. Terrific to have a physician talk about this experience. This is not uncommon in the field of medicine, is it, Dr. Fong?
No, it's not. It's not uncommon in any professional field. Lawyers, doctors, teachers, professors, athletes, and we see it all the time. You know, addiction really cuts across all humankind and across all socioeconomic statuses.
All right, let's take another call. This comes from... Rachel in Glendale, appreciate your joining us. Rachel, what's your experience with drugs or alcohol?
Hi, I am an attorney, and my first job was out on the West Side. I started drinking and taking Xanax really heavily. I have a predisposition for depression and anxiety. I think that contributes to this type of addiction, but I was really a dysfunctional alcoholic. And then from there, moved to the East Side, where, honestly, I became a functional alcoholic. I wasn't taking the Xanax anymore, but my partners and I would drink basically from, we would do our court appearances, anything that required a sober state of mind in the morning, and then lunchtime we would, in the business district of Pasadena, go, and that's where our networking would begin, lunchtime, over a bottle of wine to start with. And more than once, we would be there through the dinner hour. And then I would come home, and it started to affect my marriage. But honestly, the way that I was able to keep up with it, you keep up with the drinking, and you're on a treadmill, and you're networking, and you're talking with other attorneys who are all doing the same thing. And you're learning about the law, and you're having these great and exciting conversations. And then you go home and you pass out, and then you wake up the next morning and you start it again. And I have had to since retire from the law. I've left the law very early at a young age, after only practicing for less than 15 years, because the type of partnership that I was in was so dependent on this type of connection.
The culture was all a part of the. So have you sought out any sorts of practices or legal work where you wouldn't be in the same kind of drinking culture?
Yeah, and I really think that my disposition towards depression and anxiety contributed toward that. It made it a perfect fit, if you will. And also, I realized that there are two different types of firms that you can be in when you're practicing. And one is the firm that's a dry firm, where they do the networking at continuing education appearances and at luncheons and your rotary groups and things like that. And then you have your other type of firm where the networking and the high intensity conversations, those are done over your drinking lunches, your first bottle of wine, and then your second bottle, and then your happy hour networking events, and the wineries that you end up at, and all of a sudden all of your weekend events are surrounded by, and then it's like, well, let's pull out let's talk about some of the legal theories and this, and it's
and you're hammered by that point. Rachel, so you think you might go back though to practicing in a different environment?
I keep my license current. I do think it's possible.
Okay.
I would have to practice from home, because the you know, it's a mixed bag. Practice them from home. It keeps me out of that culture, but then I don't have that connection.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, because the part of the workplace is having that connection, even sober. Rachel, I really appreciate it. Let me go back to Professor Judy Grizel of Bucknell University. Your thoughts about Rachel's circumstance?
Well, congratulations to Rachel. I completely empathize with having to change the environment that I was in. I think it's one of the things I hear in this conversation today is that there are so many ways and opportunities and environmental facilitators for drug using. We heard from someone with opiates, someone with Xanax, someone with alcohol, someone with stimulants. So I think we really live in a culture where these opportunities are pervasive, and for those of us that are susceptible, as Rachel was saying, this is really dangerous, and it's addiction is the third leading cause of preventable death in the world. And I commend all these callers who've been able to extract themselves, but it's certainly not easy. And I think one of the reasons it's not easy is that as the brain adapts, we can function kind of only with the drug on board and not without it. So it really does take a dramatic change, either, you know, the law coming in as it did for the physician, or, enough insight, I guess, to get us to
Yeah, challenges in relationships like Rachel with her marriage. Rachel, I so appreciate your call. And again, congratulations. Congratulations to so many of our listeners who called in and have dealt this. And if you find yourself right now that you're in the place you haven't been able to extract yourself, just remember that there is hope and there are plenty of ways that you can get that help. We have some resources on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we have much more in our second hour that we'll tell you about it momentarily. It's AirTalk on 89.3 KPECC.